Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 509 for Tuesday, July 8th, 2014.
And welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, tips, and cool stuff found. We answer your questions. We share your tips. We share your cool stuff found sometimes. And all together, we like to learn something new about technology, Apple, the Mac, all that fun stuff. This episode is sponsored in part by Smile at smilesoftware.com. Today, we'll talk a little bit more about PDF Pen for OS X later in the show. Also, this episode is sponsored by Gazelle at gazelle.com, a great place to sell off all the old hardware that you don't need so that you can make room for new hardware. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in very warm Fairfield, Connecticut, this is John F. Braun.
And we have a special guest with us today, and I actually don't know what city. I don't even know where you, if you want to divulge your city, but we have Alf Watt. Hi, how you doing, Alf?
I'm doing well today. Thanks you guys for having me. I'm in sunny San Francisco today here. It's we're enjoying typical San Francisco summer.
Yeah. Well, so that
bring your parkas, leave your shorts at home.
That's right.
Cold and foggy all day.
That's right. Yeah, it's warmer there in January often than it is in July. So for those of you who don't know, Alf, please tell us a little bit about what you do and a little bit about what you've done to give it some context here.
Yeah, happily. My maybe greatest claim to internet fame, if you want to even call it that, is about 11 or 12 years ago, I started work on a little app called iStumbler, which has, you know, sort of grown up over the last decade to be, I think probably one of the most complete wireless sort of diagnostic and discovery tools. So we're covering Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, network services where you're connected, and more recently, sort of the location services aspect. And over the course of this, you know, decade, I had an opportunity to work at the Fruit Company for about 5 years on Wi-Fi user experience there for Mac OS. And most recently, I worked for Ruckus Wireless, which is an enterprise Wi-Fi vendor. We worked on an entire suite of mobile apps for them. So I managed the team that produced, I think, 6 or 10 apps, depending on how you wanted to count them. So I've been working in the sort of intersection of Wi-Fi and user experience for more than a decade now, and I absolutely love it. And I'm really happy to have a chance to talk to the crowd here.
Yeah, it's great. You know, you and I met last year. We conversed via email many times. In fact, the three of us have for years, as we've mentioned, iStumbler on the show and had Wi-Fi questions. You've participated in the show more than just writing iStumbler. You're often the expert that we go to when there's something Wi-Fi related that's beyond our scope here. But you and I got to meet last year at WWDC. I think it was last year, right? Was it last year or 2 years ago?
It was just last year.
Just last year, right? Yeah, and had a great interview that poor John Martellaro had to take and transcribe because as folks are already hearing, both Alf and I, in addition to John, are people that like to talk. So, but it was a great interview, and it's still up on Mac Observer, and we'll link to it. But when we had the opportunity to get you here on the show, that was something you couldn't do when you were at Apple and probably couldn't do when you were at Ruckus, although maybe we could have and we just missed the opportunity. But here we are. So we have collected all sorts of Wi-Fi questions from all of you that we'll talk about in a little bit. But Alf, tell us, you're now out on your own and iStumbler is at least the first of your products here. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing with iStumbler now.
It's kind of a terrifying process going from, you know, working for these companies to sort of, you know, trying to set out independently in the software marketplace. And, you know, iStumbler has been a free product for more than a decade. So there's a bit of a shock both for me and for some people moving it over to a paid app. And there's really, you know, a couple of motivations for this. The one is when I started this 10 years ago, I was a rank amateur. I, you know, didn't know much about Wi-Fi. I knew very little about programming for Mac OS. So I think when iStumbler sort of first came out, I didn't feel like it was in any way appropriate for me to charge for it, right? And I was just sort of goofing off, having an opportunity to sort of make a career out of that over the past decade, one of the problems with any developer's life, I think, is that you start looking at all of the things that you would love to do if you just had, the time and the resources. There's a lot of stuff in iStumbler, I think, to improve on. I'm, just looking at the chat here, people have mentioned Bluetooth LE, which is absolutely on the roadmap for us. So there's a lot of improvements I'd like to make to iStumbler. It's much easier to do that if I'm not juggling the day job and the app and everything else. So a little scary, big step, but I'm really hoping that I get an opportunity to make some really great tools, because I think wireless is becoming more and more important to more of our lives every day, and it's a little mysterious, it's a little magical, and I think the having really good tools to sort of pull back the veil and see what's really going on is helpful, and people care a lot about their communications. So
Yeah. Well, and the way you've priced it here, correct me if I'm wrong, is it's $20 per user, but that gets it on all of your computers. Is that right?
Yeah, $20 per human.
Per human. There you go. Perfect.
And I think that's a fair model for software. Going from surcharging you for the three machines you have never seemed particularly fair to me. I'm happy just to get that one per person. And if you'd like to license it for your enterprise, you're welcome to contact the support address. We're more than happy to work with you on that.
Sure. It's sort of the App Store model, but unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, iStumbler is not something that you can put in the App Store, right? Because you need access to things that the sandbox doesn't let you touch. Is that right?
Correct. There is a sandboxing problem that prevents me from submitting to the App Store. Crisis being opportunity. The bad news, unfortunately, for all of the apps that are in the App Store, is they're stuck where they are because of the sandboxing restriction and the way Apple has set up the rules. They are allowed only to ship bug fixes. They can't add new features. And there's a number of them in the App Store that are, sort of, almost encased in amber at this point, right? Until Apple fixes the sandbox for Wi-Fi tools, they're just going to be sort of stuck in whatever state they were at. And it's been a little more than a year now since the sandboxing restrictions came into place in full. So being outside the store is, gives me an opportunity to really innovate with the app. It's also you do recover more revenue from your sales from being outside the App Store versus in. So there's a little bit of that. I would love to put it in the App Store, though. I think what they've done with that, just in terms of making the sort of app purchase process much more approachable and user friendly, is huge. And it's, as an independent app developer, I want to have access to the best distribution channel possible. And I keep my fingers crossed, and I keep poking my friends back at Apple to try and make it happen.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and they will do whatever it is they will do. Right. And you got to do what you want to do in the interim. And that's just how it needs to be. That's right. Yeah.
Okay. I got a question, Alf.
Go ahead and hit me.
I don't want to hit you. I don't even know you.
We just met.
But, all right, so iStumbler, I've been a fan for a long time, and Dave and I have highlighted it on numerous occasions because it's, to me, just one of the best tools to, scope out your Wi-Fi universe, if you will. But the one thing that I'm curious about, the features in here are just awesome for me to understand what's happening, the channel width and the channel and all that I'm looking right now. But here's a head scratcher, and I'm sure you can address this. So, as you probably know, there are third-party adapters that some of us are privy to. Now, the one that I was a big fan of for a while, though they seem to have dropped off the face of the earth, was the Wi-Fi. And now the more recent one, which I'm very enthusiastic about, is the Bear Extender. Now, as far as I can see, unless I'm doing something wrong, if I have a Bear Extender plugged in, which is a Wi-Fi receiver, plugs in the USB port, iStumbler, and it seems no other Mac Wi-Fi utility can see it without getting, or maybe you can get geeky because that's kind of what we're about here, but what's happening there? Is it a problem with the way Apple architects Wi-Fi access or what?
Yes. So in order for a third party Wi-Fi adapter, whether it's USB or any other bus technology to work natively, there is an IOKit family that Apple would have to open up, and it's not currently open. So what developers are able to do right now is extend. So in the IOKit, which is the driver architecture for Mac OS X, there are base classes for various types of things. So there's a display base class and a network adapter one. And the one that third-party developers have access to is just for Ethernet-like devices. Okay, so you're able to, you know, the bare extenders and other third-party manufacturers have done the work to integrate their products. But you'll notice with bare extender, they provide their own user interface for selecting networks and joining.
Right.
Right, so they're not integrated with the system utilities in the same way.
Right, and that makes me sad because their utility is very light in what it tells you, you know, compared to iStumbler or other utilities. And I wish I could get more info, but I can't. Is there a possibility that you or someone could you conceivably, if it was worth your time, write a plugin, or would they have to write a plugin, or how does that?
So I've talked to the bare extender team there because I have this exact question myself. I have one of their 11AC adapters here. Yes, it's certainly possible, and I would love to work with them on doing it. We haven't gotten to the point where we've sort of agreed to move forward with it. I think I've looked at what they have there currently, and there's some there's a little bit of engineering debt to get paid back before it can really work, and that's sort of part of the sticking point. But yeah, it's. I think, the information that iStumbler gets from the system is, of course, limited to what the system provides. One of the advantages of working closely with a third party vendor is we can actually pull in a lot more information. So I'm eager to do that. I would, love to work with Bear or any other third party company that that has hardware to do that.
Now that you're on your own, you have the potential, you have the freedom to do that, the flexibility to do that if it makes sense in terms of the grand scheme of the rest of the stuff you're doing, which is great.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, as you said, engineering debt. The thing is, somebody would have to allocate time and resources and money.
Right.
So you do that. And it's like, do you do that or they do that? And
exactly. The bare extender stuff, not to, shame them, but they're if you notice, their stuff is all still 32-bit. So that was sort of the big the big catching point there is I would have had to do some serious conversion work. And, without access to their source, that's that just takes time to negotiate. So, sure. So in that case, there's a very, one specific technical issue. The rest of it. Yeah, no, there's definitely opportunity for that. There's also, we could do iStumbler branded Wi-Fi adapters. I'm not against that.
Ooh.
Get someone to do a little pocket knife shaped plastic enclosure.
Yeah,
because I got to say, between the Wi-Fi, and again, I think they just abandoned things at a certain point. Because it doesn't work on my current setup or bare extender. All I got to say is the bare extender. I'm picking up stuff, as the name implies. I'm picking up, like my local cable company. I'm picking this up where my MacBook or my Mac Mini doesn't even see it. And it's right. Just an awesome product, but it's limited in some ways. And that's one of them is it tells you almost nothing about the specifics of what's happening around you.
Yeah. The bare extender product is, it's 100% in the antennas. They just put, because you're outside the enclosure, you have a much bigger antenna. So then that works great. It's you know, the other thing that you can do with custom hardware, or just, you know, dedicated hardware that's not the built-in Wi-Fi radio, would be sort of more detailed look, having a more detailed look at the RF spectrum, right? So iStumbler does a good job of showing you Wi-Fi networks. What it can't show you are things like baby monitors and TV extenders and all of the other, you know, cordless phones, old cordless phones, all of the other 2.4 and 5 gigahertz radio technology that we use that's not Wi-Fi. So this is, you know, one of the great challenges for people is dealing with those kind of interference problems.
That's interesting. Okay. Yeah.
Thanks. And that may be a good lead in, maybe, Dave, to our first question.
Yeah, we have a question from the chat room. I'll say hi to everybody at MacGeekGab.com/stream. And Alex Santos in the chat room asks a good question. I mean, you're right, John. This is a great lead in. The question is, where do we send feature requests now, you know, now that you've got all of us geeks thinking about, hey, wait a minute, there's stuff that we can't do that we could do if only, you know, this happened. So is it on Twitter at iStumbler, or is there a place on iStumbler.net where people should go to contact you, Al?
You know, there's a support forum on the store. You're welcome to type stuff in there. Just an email to support@istumbler.net goes right to me. I am the support staff, as well as development and marketing and everything else. So,
right. Great. Okay, cool. That's helpful. And yeah, like I said, or like you said, John, this brings to mind all kinds of things. You know, Buffalo, I'm a big fan of their routers, and they make some great Wi-Fi, USB Wi-Fi adapters, but there is either limited or no Mac software for them. And there should be, because it's good stuff. So it's all kinds of good stuff. It's good.
Yeah, Buffalo does a pretty, I actually have a bunch of Buffalo routers here for their DDWRT routers for a special project. And yeah, I've liked the hardware so far.
Yeah, they do a good job with the hardware. It's the DDWRT thing is always it's a moving target at first, and then it settles in with each new piece of hardware. And I feel like the 1750 DHPD, which is their latest DDWRT router, finally now has firmware that is truly stable and reliable and very fast and all of that good stuff, which is great. You know, it's nice to have a dual core router.
It's amazing that we've come to that point. Yes.
Yeah, it's crazy, right? I mean, that router is an 800 megahertz dual core chip in it. And it's crazy, right? I mean, I always think back to my first computer, which was an Apple IIc, which was, you know, 1600 times slower than that. And
you're dating yourself a little bit, but yeah,
I've
come a long ways.
That's right. We've been doing this show over 9 years. So dating ourselves is something that we've sort of, you know, left in the past. So we don't worry about that anymore here. Folks know who we are. That's right. All right. I'm sure there's going to be more of this as we get into some tangents here, but I want to answer some questions that people have sent in, because I think that's going to lead to some great discussions. First, I definitely want to talk about our first sponsor, which is Smile at smilesoftware.com. They make all kinds of great apps. They make Text Expander. They make Disk Label, and they make PDF Pen for both iOS and OS X. And today I get to talk about PDF Pen for OS X. In a nutshell, what this does is it allows you to edit and manipulate PDFs on your Mac. You can take an image and store it in there of your signature, or of, you can store all kinds of things in there. I store my signature in there that I've scanned in. You can also store, which I do, my name, so that when I have to sign a document, I can just pull things right out of there. That's all stored in iCloud, or can be stored in iCloud if you want it to be. And then that will sync from your Mac to your iOS devices, so you've got those wherever you want them. You can fill out and save PDF forms with it. And with PDF Pen Pro, you can actually create your own PDF forms, which is really cool and super handy. One thing that it just always blows me away with PDF Pen is that you can take a PDF and you can actually edit the text inside it. Hopefully you wouldn't do this for nefarious purposes, but you can do it for any purpose you want. You can, you know, if you get a PDF, say that somebody created for you and it's got a typo in it, you can fix that typo. All kinds of possibilities open up, and it's super handy. You can mark up PDFs. You can add stickies to them. You can add all kinds of different things so that if you're If you've got a document that you're reviewing and somebody sends it to you, you can mark it up and send it back to them. You can reorder pages. You can remove pages, or you can take out, you know, a segment of your PDF of the pages from your PDF and save that as a separate PDF. And if you scan something in that doesn't have editable text, PDF Pen has an OCR engine in it, meaning it can take that text and or take that image that was scanned and turn it into text that you can then edit or simply save as a PDF. Once it's converted to text, it actually takes up a lot less space than an image does. And that makes it really, really helpful for portability, all that good stuff. As I said, it's available for iPad and iPhone. They also have PDF Pen Scan Plus, which is a mobile scanner app that saves directly to PDFs, which is really cool and something that I know I was looking for before they released it. So check all this out. SmileSoftware.com. Make sure you let them know that we sent you. They will ask you during the checkout process when you are purchasing, if you're purchasing on their site, and it lets them know that what we're doing here helps them out. And that's a good quid pro quo. It helps us and we appreciate that. So check them out. SmileSoftware.com. And with that, we will go to the first email that we have here, which is from Alex. Great question to start with. He says, for those of us that live in high density housing, like an apartment complex, what can you do to improve communication among your own devices, preferably without just escalating a wattage battle with the neighbors? In my complex, I can see somewhere between 7 and 20 distinct Wi-Fi networks, depending on the current neighbor's device I'm using and where exactly I'm standing. The signal in my bedroom is good enough to browse the internet, but insufficient for streaming standard definition video, even though it's only about 20 feet from the access point. Right now, I'm extending a wired connection to stationary devices with MoCA, which is Ethernet over coax. And he says, but that doesn't help the iPhone and iPad. I could add another access point on one of the MoCA endpoints, but that just seems like I'm adding to the problem. Is there a geekier solution? And I will throw this to you, Alf, to start us, and we'll pass it around.
Sure. Yeah. Before we get on to that, if I can say really quickly, just a note about your sponsor. I know the guys from Smile very well. They're here in San Francisco. And not only is it great products, there's great people making them. So yeah, please. PDF Penza has saved my bacon a number of times. I highly recommend it. So
awesome.
I can throw that on the fire there quickly.
Absolutely.
But getting back to the apartment complex, question, density is one of the greatest challenges that we're going to be facing in wireless moving, you know, into the next decade or century even. And if you look at the trend, if you sort of rewind the tape back to the birth of radio, we had very, very large transmitters on very, very high points with very, very high power. So like the original sort of ship to shore telegraph systems, they were putting more power into those antennas than we would, you know, consider safe in this day and age. We've learned a lot about EM safety, you know, so the guys that do climb up on like an AM, if you're working near AM equipment, for example, you have to wear a bunny suit, a special sort of Faraday jacket to protect you from RF burns. And over time, every new generation of wireless technology has moved to smaller coverage area with more radios. Cellular is a really good example of this. So the original AMPS cellular network, the cells were still a pretty good size and the radios were still pretty big. And then we went to digital cellular and the cells shrunk again. And every step down this chain of wireless technology, we've got more smaller cells, and that trend is going to continue. I predict until we basically have one access point per room in every human inhabited space, and it's strictly physics that dictates this. So this is the speed of light is a big part of what we do, why we do a lot of the things that we do in RF. It is a fundamental limit that we actually hit fairly often, in its different flavors. So long story short, the correct answer to this question is put in more access points and turn the power down. And the you know, this is something that actually enterprise deployments are pretty good at. But unfortunately, consumer devices, because you typically only have one per household, are geared to, you know, sort of turn the power up to as high as they feel like they need to go. So if you have routers that allow you to manage your transmit levels, then I would put in that second router and just turn the radios down on both of them. And that's going to actually help you get better bandwidth throughout the house. And the two access points will contend with each other less if they're on close or the same channels. But yeah, the overall trend in radio and the way to deal with this sort of highly congested situation is more access points at lower power levels. If you have the technology to manage that. So
will that work though? I mean, if Alex goes and gets, a couple of access points or has a couple of access points that allow mm-hmm. him to turn the power down, and he does that, he's being a responsible radio citizen. But if his neighbors don't turn their power down, will that actually hurt Alex now, or will it still help him because he's just got better proximity to his transmitters?
Right. So power and radio is a complex subject. And it a lot of times, you know, people talk about, well, I'm going to just turn the transmitters up to the maximum volume. And there are situations where that works well. But, you know, lock yourself in a closet with a microphone or a megaphone and start talking and you're going to blow your ears out pretty fast. And it's not, we face very similar problems in Wi-Fi. So, everyone turning their radio amplifiers up to maximum and putting the biggest possible antennas they have, eventually, if we keep going down that road, there's sort of a tragedy of the commons that happens. You know, the well runs dry because everyone's taking two buckets instead of one. So this is something that I think the IEEE is working on, sort of adaptive power level management. Radio resource management is becoming more and more critical. And it's, spectrum management is probably going to be one of the big sort of resource issues of our time for the next generation or so.
So how we
manage it and, yeah.
So this is something that we can deal with as users on our own in the short term, but in the long term, we really need the router manufacturers to help us solve this problem in a more automated way.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, going back to the question of, you know, the sort of eventual shape of the network, right, where you have access point like devices practically everywhere. There's two corollaries to that, one of which is they're all going to be talking very quietly to each other, right? And the second one is that there's a lot of them, right? So you can imagine, you know, that's 7 to 8 to 10 billion devices, roughly, just ballparking. And that's a lot of devices to manage. So we're going to have to figure out much more autonomous management systems, right? Ways for access points to do the RF management they need to do smartly, and for the greater good. You know, there's a lot of times you end up having to make trade-offs. You know, this would be great for me, but it would be bad for my neighbors, right? If I had the jumpy house in front of my house every day, my kids would love it, but the neighbors eventually will.
So is 5 gigahertz something that we should all move to for the devices that would support it because it's so bad at going through walls? I mean, is that part of the discussion here?
Well, the next step after 5 gig is 60, which is really bad at going through everything.
All right. But I want to add to that. So I got a question here. Let me get a word in here. So
yeah, go ahead, John. Yeah.
This is great stuff. So I remember actually working with, I think it was the early 90s, Proxim was one of the manufacturers. So the thing is, spread spectrum, which I guess you could consider Wi-Fi, is designed to operate. Whereas, as you implied, Alf, I guess, you know, whereas with AM and stuff like that, it was a battle of power. You can have Wi-Fi operating on the same channel and the same frequency. And they'll get along, but not as well. And I think that was, you know, what the person writing the question said. But I guess what Dave was leading to, but I want to expand on his question was, all right, so you have a number of parameters that you do have control over. So there's the channel, as Dave implied, there's the frequency and there's the width, and that you have control over. So Could you comment on, you know, that aspect of, you know, if I had to set up something? Now, you gave some good guidelines. Okay, you know, create multiple access points. And that, you know, I actually do that here. I have two. I have an extension and a primary. But if you could comment on that.
Yeah, so the best current practice right now, so in 2.4 gigahertz where channel space is scarce, we very, very heavily, highly recommend only using 20 megahertz channels. Yes, yes, you lose some bandwidth, but it's much better for your neighbors and it's much better for your Bluetooth devices, which are also sharing that spectrum. So that's one thing to look out for. At Apple, we made the decision not to support 40 megahertz in 2.4 because it caused too much problem for Bluetooth in particular. And I think that's become the standard. So that's the first thing. Is, you know, there are routers that let you do 40 megahertz 2.4 channels. Please don't. And then in 5 gigahertz, we have a lot more space. We have, you know, the propagation is less than it is in 2.4. So the signal doesn't carry as far. Using 40 megahertz channels in 5 gig is, I think, completely acceptable, and you know that there's no problem there because there's so much more bandwidth. And if you sit down and chart it out, it's kind of amazing how much more. And we're adding bandwidth there. So the FCC has unlocked a block that actually joins two other blocks, and now we have a bigger continuous block in 5 gig starting next year to just add bandwidth. One thing that's happening with 11AC is the new 11AC radios rollout is you're looking at 80 megahertz and in some cases 160 megahertz channels. And this is, you know, we have to, the box has to have a better number on it every year. Otherwise, no one buys anything. So in order to hit that sort of marketing number, they've just started consuming channel space. And I'm a little worried about that as a long-term trend, the need to, you know, drive the data rate of the modems up or the access points up is going to push us into a place where we're, you know, consuming more and more spectrum. Now, the good news is that there's a degree of cognitive radio going on with at least the 160 megahertz channels. So a conformant 11AC access point that's behaving well will not create that 160 megahertz channel if it sees that there's other people using it. So we're going to see a lot more of that, what we call cognitive radio technology, which is essentially, you know, listen before you talk, is what it really comes down to. And a lot of radios don't do a very good job of that. So we're going to start seeing, I think, a lot more smarts in the access points and in the radios as to, you know, when it's a good idea for them to start talking.
Cool. Anything else, John, before we, as I anticipated, we could take any one of these questions and spend the entire show digging into it. And I love that. So we'll let a lot of these go pretty deep. But is there more we need to do on this one or shall we move on? John?
I think we're good. You know, the only thing that strikes me is that the person that wrote the question is, I mean, it's almost sacrilege to say this, but if you can at all avoid doing wireless and get something wired... do that instead. And Dave has been a proponent. I'm just suggesting that Dave is I haven't used this, but Dave is a big proponent of a power line adapters. But I would say if you could at all run, I'll stand behind this. If you can at all run a wired connection, you know, wired, I think is almost always going to give you better throughput, but that's not always possible. So
there's a lot of good things to say about wired connections. They're very reliable. They're very fast. They're very electric. They're energy wise. They're inexpensive. So yeah, if you can, it's usually preferable. But you know,
there's no contention. I'm not battling with anybody on a switch. Well, maybe a little bit. But,
Well, with your iPhone and your iPad, a wired connection is impossible. Essentially impossible.
Correct. Right. Yeah. Right. Right.
Challenging.
There you go. Thank you. Yes.
So I think the next question here is about of Wi-Fi antenna orientation. Which
Pete asks, he says, is there an orientation for the previous series of Airport Express base stations? And really, we can kind of open this up to a more general thing that maximizes the reception and range. So, yeah, go ahead, Alf. Yeah.
So the antenna systems in those airports are definitely designed to be used in the natural orientation that you put them in. I actually, I'm not entirely clear on which previous generation he's talking about. There is the ones that plugged into the wall that looked very much like MacBook chargers, which are the 11G and 11N. Just 11G.
11G, yeah.
AirPort and then- Express. For that one, antenna orientation, I don't actually remember how they were oriented in there. So I don't know. I don't have a good answer on that one. The newer 11Ns, the ones that look like a white Apple TV, they're definitely designed to be put foot down on a hard surface because the antennas are arrayed around the outside edge.
I've heard the folks from Buffalo kind of rant on about this, and for their own products, they used to make routers, and some companies still do, that have movable antennas. And I remember the folks at Buffalo told me, we've stopped doing that because people don't know how to aim antennas. So we have them inside the box and they're not changeable, and we found it to be better. But if someone does have a router that has aimable, movable antennas, any general advice that we can give to them?
What I always do when I run into those, and there's another question here, well, as it sort of implies polarization, there is actually a difference for a dipole antenna. So the rubber ducky, looks like an antenna.
Yeah.
There's an orientation difference between vertical and horizontal, and we call it polarization. What you want for those systems is that the client and the access point have matched polarization. So in the case of a access point with two rubber duckies, I habitually, whenever I see one, point one straight up and lay the other one flat. So you get a vertical and a horizontal polarized antenna pair with that setup. There's a level of sort of radio esoterica there that very few people have. So that's how I do them. I think you're almost all modern access points that I see now, especially with N and certainly with AC. And I think required for AC phase two because of the TX beamforming. We don't use the dipole antennas very much anymore. We tend to use what's called a planar flat array or a patch antenna. And you see these inside of products. They're, just a little clip of silicon that's maybe a centimeter and a half across that, acts like a different radiation pattern from it. It's more of a shotgun than a donut.
Okay. Okay.
Right. So the little rabbit ear antennas, you sort of have to imagine a big donut around them. There's a torus, it's a toroidal pattern. A PFA is a little guy, and the reason they're arrayed around the outside edge of the AirPort Express and the new AirPort Extremes is because they're directional. They point in a particular direction away from their ground plane. So it's actually what you have is sort of it's like having a bunch of lights arrayed around the top edge that are shining out from it.
Okay. So yeah. Okay. Huh.
But that brings up an interesting question because, from what I recall, from taking physics courses and just doing some RFID work and all that, mm-hmm. in general, I think 2.4 is sensitive to orientation, and that if you have one antenna that's horizontal, then the best receiver is another horizontal antenna.
Uh-oh.
Is that
lower? The lower the frequency, the bigger an issue orientation is. So, if you go down into the AM frequencies, it's a big deal, which is why those car aerials are all vertical. Whereas, FM, which is higher frequency, they used to have like they used to have a wire antenna like in the windshield that would go up and across. So FM is less sensitive to orientation. And then as we get up into the, five, at 60 gig, I don't think it really matters at all anymore.
All right. So in the microwave, 2.4 and above. Okay. No, that's mm-hmm. that's good to know because, looking at I have an AirPort Extreme right now, and I'm going to assume the antenna is horizontal. Whereas if I look in my MacBook Pro, I'm going to assume that the antenna being in the case is vertical. But you're saying that
in the laptops, the antennas are actually in the hinge. They're in that little black piece between the screen and the keyboard has the antenna array in it.
Oh, so is it also horizontal then?
They are horizontally polarized in that configuration.
Oh. Okay. Well, in that case, then it does match.
Or horizontally, aligned anyways. So the MacBook Airs have two antennas packed into the clutch barrel, and the MacBook Pros have three. So it's a two and three stream Wi-Fi solution, depending on which line.
Right. 300 megabits at N versus 450. Theoretical maximum. Are they
still shared? I think Dave, you stumbled across this once, but I think the antennas, are they still in most of the Apple equipment shared between Bluetooth and Wi-Fi, depending on what's happening? Or
that varies model by model.
Okay.
I'm not at liberty to go any further into that one.
Yeah. No, I remember it was the first, oh man. Oh, it was years ago that somebody at Apple, I think it was Greg Jozriak, told me, you know, oh, we bounce back and forth, but that was only single stream. It was two antennas. They were in the bezel and it was single stream, Wi-Fi, and it would pick the best one for Wi-Fi, depending on where the access point was or where it could get the strongest signal, and then dump Bluetooth off on the other one. But I think that was a titanium PowerBook. I mean, this was a long time ago that was the case.
Very, it's lossy and hard to switch antenna leads for a single radio. So for a Bluetooth radio to switch between one or the other would be difficult. The Wi-Fi radio can pick one or the other as a primary.
Okay.
But yeah, it's coexistence between Wi-Fi and Bluetooth within this is a huge issue. Yes. Yeah. And one of the things that I did was work on the factory software that they used to keep that from happening in the manufacturing process.
Cool. Right. All right. Let's jump.
Could you comment?
Oh, go ahead.
Well, I think it's applicable here, but
yeah, go ahead.
Could you give your spin? So the concern was from the person that wrote in, well, how do I get the best performance? And one tool that I'm just wild about and I use often and I love doing this sort of thing is NetSpot. And doing site surveys. So I guess, short of, you know, there's theory and there's practice and, you know, doing a site survey, well, you're going to get most of the facts. Now, maybe you have to interpret them properly, but could you comment a bit on tools like NetSpot or site surveys or, you know, how should, you know, is that something that should maybe play into your strategy of, you know, setting up your Wi-Fi environment?
Well, certainly for, you know, if you're an enterprise customer, you're someone who's supporting an enterprise deployment and you want to verify your installation, I think site survey tools like NetSpot and NetSpot is an excellent one, by the way, are super helpful. And, you know, for most people in the home scenario, it might be a bit of overkill. But you know, it certainly can't hurt. I think if I was an IT person who was responsible for maintaining the quality of the network, I would, you know, periodically run a site survey just to, you know how my user's performance was. And this is a big, you know, like I said, the having worked on wireless usability, you know, just as in a sort of an aside, one of the big things about networking, in general, is the best user interface for networking is absolutely none, right? You know, if you go read, you know, all of the science fiction canon where they talk about, you know, like, you know, a Neuromancer that our hero hacker jacks into the cyber network or whatever. There is no, you know, asking the guy for the router password. There's no going and buying the day pass from the hotspot. Is you just turn the thing on and it works, and that's what we all want. So the trade off to make that happen is we're going to have to figure out how to get, and this is happening slowly in the industry, is we're going to have to be able to figure out how to ask devices what their experience is. And so the network sort of needs to be able to aggregate that and make adjustments based on what the clients are telling it. And there's, you know, more and more of that as time goes by. But I think the trend over time is going to be, you know, similar to the radio resource management issue with turning the power down when there's a lot of other radios around, you know, tuning precisely how the access points react to different clients is helps a lot.
And is that,
and a lot of the decisions have to be made so fast, it's almost impossible to manually intervene. So,
and is that what beamforming, I mean, is that one step down that path? Is that what that's doing effectively?
Different. So beamforming is, I mean, there are different methods of doing beamforming, depending on, you know, how much hardware you want to throw at the problem.
Okay.
Beamforming is a yeah, absolutely. So in beamforming systems, you have the antenna array, and it's always an array, is looking for the best combination of factors to send signal to each individual client, right? And the limit of this, there was a company, that made called Vivato, and they made a Wi-Fi panel antenna that was as big as a car. And it literally had more than 1,000 separate radios in it, or hundreds, maybe not that many. It was a few years ago. And they, you know, they had a system where you could put this thing up on top of a building and it would essentially pinpoint any number of devices. So it was able to, you know, so for stadiums and places where you just have an incredibly large number of people, you have to use that kind of technique and technology to focus the beams in the right place. This helps, you know, this ultimately is going to help us with the sort of congestion problem. So a beamforming gives you what we call spatial diversity. You can point the energy in one direction and not point it in another direction. And that allows, you know, so you have channel and space and time are the three main, you know, places to run from interference. And that beamforming is going to be a lot. And I think the type of beamforming that's in 11AC, the sort of active beamforming, is going to sort of raise the beamforming level in the industry up to a much higher level than it has been. But the new Apple Extreme base station has a, you know, very advanced beamforming solution in it. And the antenna array is designed specifically for that. So, you know, we're going that way as an industry for sure.
Cool. All right, let's jump to Slough's question, because it's all kind of interrelated, but it'll spark us down a different path. So let's take it away, Slough.
Greetings, John and David. Slough, how you doing? So listen, here's my Wi-Fi dilemma. Oh man, and I was gonna send it to feedback at MacGeekGab, but you know, I don't know. I couldn't remember whether it was feedback or feedbag. Anyway, I was going to type this, but, you know, I'll get carpal tunnel syndrome. So here it is in a huge nutshell. I have two networks, all right? I have a home network, and then in the same building, but several floors away, I have a business network, okay? And here's the thing. I have my laptop set to sort of like the priority is my business network. And the thing is, everything works fine until I go home. And then, like, I flip open my laptop and it always, like, latches onto my business network where the signal strength isn't that good, and I sort of like constantly have to like switch it over manually from the menu bar, you know, to the home network. And I thought that in the network system preferences, you know, the location thing was the answer. Oh, I thought, okay, great, let me create one for home, create one for work. But the thing is, if I drag the priority, sort of the networks into a different order, it's not sort of exclusive to each location. Like if I change the order of the network, it seems I can only have one order. And so I don't know, I'm scratching my head. I'm thinking, shouldn't it be that you know, sort of each location profile is completely independent in terms of that network list? Apparently not, I guess. And I'm just at a loss. If you guys have any ideas, I would love to hear them. Thanks so much, and I won't get caught. See ya. Bye.
All right. So this is a question. I mean, Slough has a unique situation,
wow.
But that's actually a good one. But it brings up, yeah, it's something that we all kind of have dealt with in different environments at times. So my first answer, and this may not be preferable for Slough because he's got his business in his home, but my answer would be name them all the same and let the client decide which access point to connect to. But maybe, Alf, you have a better answer. I don't know. Or maybe you don't.
Yeah. There's a question about how to fake a guest network, and you know what, and so that, and that gets to what the purpose of a guest network is. So the first question is, okay, why have two separate networks? You know, in this case, if you know there's a business requirement, so you know, for instance, the processing credit card information, for instance, there are specific legal requirements that you have to go through if you're holding on to that. So depending on what the business is, there may be a valid reason to have a separate network with different security. It's unfortunately kind of a tricky proposition to make one work and the other one not. The particular, so Slough has correctly reverse engineered the system, the sort of network configuration issue there. There is a single list of Wi-Fi networks to which you have previously associated and a single list of preferred order. You don't get one per network location. And I'm sorry about that. I hope we get to keep having network locations moving forward.
Right.
That could easily become a victim of the simplification of, the continuing simplification of macOS. As it's a confusing feature that causes all sorts of support problems. Yep. If you don't have an overriding security reason to separate the two networks, then the suggestion to flatten them out and use the same network name is the simplest solution to the problem. If you do have some other requirement for it, I'm afraid there's really no simple answer. As long as you can see a network that's higher priority than another one, the system will try and join it. Even if it's just at the edge of, there are definitely situations where you can connect to an access point that you can just barely see. It doesn't provide useful service while there's another one on your list that's much closer, that would provide useful service. And I would say that's a bug in the macOS Wi-Fi client. So you can always submit those to Apple. And I'm sorry. That's an unfortunate case, though.
Yep. Okay. All right.
Let me speculate on a solution here. So one, I'm wondering if this is something you could script. And Alf, I'm actually a .NET programmer. Don't hate me for that. But that's my expertise. I've dabbled with Xcode. I still like .NET and Visual Studio. It's pretty awesome, actually. I don't know if you've mess with it, but anyways,
I've had enough exposure to .NET to say I'm very sorry.
Dude, it's really not that bad. It's a pretty rich set, but I'm trying to remember the people that make the cross platform tool set.
I did some work on Dunbarton, so yeah, again, I'm sorry.
Well, all I say is, hey, for what I've programmed for, including low-level stuff, .NET isn't that bad. So we'll agree to disagree. But to me, it seems just a simple matter of being able to write a rule. And I don't know under OS X whether you do this with AppleScript, but the rule to me would be, okay, if signal strength, or otherwise known as RSSI, right, RF terminology, if signal strength of this access point is stronger than this one, then connect to one or the other. Now, I don't know if you could do this through AppleScript, or this is a tool that we have mentioned. I haven't really used that much. I think Dave has, called Control Plane, or even Automator. And I don't know if the OS makes that level of detail available, and I think you would know better than I would. You know, could you write a script saying, you know, check this and check this, and whoever has the stronger signal, because it sounds like that's what Slough's looking for. Wants the best signal.
Control Plane is you can have all kinds of different criteria that you can use to decide
context.
Right, context.
Is signal strength one of the pieces of context?
Well, I'm
suspecting maybe it's not.
It wouldn't need to be necessarily. You could say, if I can see this Wi-Fi printer, or even if I can, right? I mean, there's all kinds of different things that you could use to latch onto. If I can see this Bluetooth device, then, you know, be certain that my context is A versus B, right? That would be a way to deal with that. But the question then is, if we can get the context right, how do we then tell it pick this particular Wi-Fi network? And maybe Control Plane will do that. I don't know. Maybe Control Plane.
Because right now the rule set, which is, you know, here's the priority list, and it's not granular to the location. That's his observation and his complaint. And I understand what he's saying.
Yeah.
Is that it's dumb. It's like, well, it's not dumb. It's just, it was just written that way. It was just written where, okay, here's the priority, no matter what your location is. I guess the other solution is, okay, let's write the Wi-Fi software so that each location has its own unique preferred network, right? That's the other thing.
So yeah, and we were just talking about network locations versus physical locations. So there's right. there's a couple of different, you know, questions about what we mean when we say that. I think, you know, in my mind, the rule is connect to the right network, which is, you know, boils down to the old technology cry of, you know, do what I mean. And it is definitely a hard or it's a complex decision. Certainly location sensitivity is coming up. In fact, I think I saw a patent come through Patently Apple where they talked about, you know, location, physical location sensitive security constraints. So your passcode is turned off when you're at home, but it's on whenever you're out and about. Maybe it's off when you're connected to your car kit, so you don't have to unlock your phone while you're driving. Not that you should ever touch your phone while you're driving, but you know, So the system reacting to the environment, Wi-Fi, the Wi-Fi client, unfortunately, is a little bit sort of stuck in, you know, I sit down, I open up my laptop and it's going to pick the right network.
If we rewind and have him throttle down the power on the transmitter of the router in his office such that it doesn't reach two floors down to his living abode?
If the purpose of having that separate network is security, I think that's a double win.
Yeah. I don't know that. I mean, I can't think of anything else that would be doable today. Right. I mean, there's all kinds of things that should be solved and the ways it should be. And hopefully it will be. But today, maybe that's his answer. I don't know.
I think that might be a good interim solution if the hardware that he's using has that capability. I think there's actually this is an area where I think there's a lot of room for improvement in the marketplace. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, you know, that's right. Opportunity is exactly what you need these days. So that's a good thing for you.
Well, I saw someone else suggest here. Did this come up? You could set up one access point to do Mac filtering or kind of reverse Mac filtering and then it could block.
But he wants it to work when he's in his office.
Yes.
Right. When he's okay, in the studio, yeah, he wants it to work. Yeah. All right. So along these lines, a year ago when we talked, I asked you this one question. I want to re-ask it and just for confirmation or perhaps if there's a change. But one of the things you sort of enlightened us to last year was the whole concept of let the client decide, name the networks the same and let the client decide. And that's true not only for when you have multiple routers on the same spectrum, but also when you have routers on different spectrums or radios on different spectrums, both 2.4 and 5 gigahertz in your home, name the networks the same and let the client decide. Now that's easier said than done at times. In fact, this weekend I was at my uncle's house and his Netgear router would not let me name the 2.4 and 5 gigahertz networks the same, which was sort of annoying. So is that still your advice? And why would Netgear build their routers not to do that?
Well, let's take a step back and let's look at, you know, what is a Wi-Fi network, right?
Right.
So the box that you purchase is an access point, right? That access point contains one or more radios. Although I think actually, and I'm being imprecise there because I believe in the technical specification, each radio is an access point, but for, you know, and that's only going to confuse things, I guess, moving forward. But the first thing to understand is as far as the client is concerned, a single access point with two radios doesn't look any different than two separate access points with a single radio.
Makes sense.
Okay. So, a regular, you know, a Wi-Fi network has, a Wi-Fi radio has an identifier called the BSSID, which is the basic service set identifier. And that's its MAC address, right? And so we're familiar, that's one of the, you know, one of the things that iStumbler will display to you. That identifies a particular radio. The string, the network name, the SSID or service set identifier identifies the network as a group. Okay, and there's a couple of issues with this. The first one is that the clients, because of the specification, assume that all networks with the same name are all see, it's hard to keep all the terms straight. I'm goofing up as I go. All radios that it can see that have the same name are attached to the same network. And in some cases, we know that's just wrong, right? So Linksys is a popular example. Sure. So like all those Linksys networks don't point to the same place. I mean, ultimately, they all go to the internet, you hope.
Yeah, point made, right.
Yeah, yeah, the path there might be a little bit different. I've seen operators try to stitch together a bunch of different networks under the same name and then come back and say, well, we don't understand why the clients aren't roaming correctly. And it's like, well, they're not supposed to. Sorry. Right. This is the specifications have to evolve to deal with this stuff. Right. We didn't build Wi-Fi planning to make operator networks. We built it for home and business networks.
Right.
So there's some adaption that has to happen there. So whether you have two access points, both on 2.4 with separate on separate channels, or whether you have a single access point with two radios, 1 and 2, 4 and 5, the clients treat them more or less the same. They do a scan of all the channels they think they should be looking at, and that varies country to country. And they pick this. They pick the signal. They pick the radio, not necessarily with the best signal, but the one that they predict will give them the best throughput. So there's, you know, because of 5 gigahertz propagation slowness, or because it doesn't travel as far, you will often see a 5 gigahertz signal that is weaker, has a lower RSSI, which is received signal strength indicator, is what that expands out to, by the way, if you're not familiar. So RSSI is really just signal strength. You can get better throughput on a 5 gig radio at a lower RSSI because it has wider channels and higher level encodings and other tricks, right? So there are situations where you're going to connect to not necessarily the strongest radio, but the radio you think is going to give you the best throughput. And those are non-trivial decisions to make, right? Getting back to the point about, you know, every different model of Mac and phone and, you know, every device in the marketplace has a slightly different antenna system, which have different strengths and weaknesses. So you really do have to leave it to the clients to make the decisions, because they're the ones that have the information about what they're seeing. And the case of the, you said it was a D-Link or a D-Link one that wouldn't let you set them the same?
It was a Netgear router.
Netgear?
Yeah. Yeah.
I would actually bet that they did that because they got a sufficient number of support complaints from people who are having trouble with roaming. Like, just in terms of why they would do that as a business process point of view, I bet it was enough of a support issue that they thought they would get less calls, even though I don't think that's the best way to set up the network.
So sure. Yeah, no, it makes sense. That makes
they're
sense.
They're not optimizing for your user experience. They're optimizing for their own support cost. But, you know,
that actually makes perfect sense. Even if it's just the people that call and say, I can't find my 5 gigahertz network. What do you mean this thing has two radios in it? Right. That's
exactly.
Yep. All right. So we've got a couple more things we'll go through here, but I want to take a minute and thank and mention our second sponsor for this episode, which is Gazelle at gazelle.com. Gazelle runs a really cool service. It's super, super simple. The whole idea is you take your old devices, your old iOS devices, your old Mac devices that you don't use anymore, and you turn them into cash. And they make this happen pretty much magically and without any more effort from you than is absolutely necessary. You start by going to their website. You don't even tell them who you are at first, and you just shop through. You tell them you click what kind of device you have, and you can do this from your iPhone. I have done the entire process from my phone, and their mobile UI is perfect. It works great. You start by telling them what general classification is it a tablet? Is it a phone? Is it a laptop? And then you drill down, you tell them what kind, what size, what color, what carrier, if it's a phone or an iPad that's on the, you know, that's got 4G or even 3G. And you drill down and you tell them what kind of condition it's in, and they give you a price. If you like the price, then they ask for your name, but only because they've got to send you a box. They need your address to send you this box. And you've paid nothing, right? Money never leaves your hands. The box arrives free of charge to you. you put the device in the box. The box has the tape in it. It's got a new shipping label that you slap on the front. You send it back to them. They evaluate it, make sure that A, you put something in the box, and what you put in the box is what you said you were going to put in the box. They also evaluate the quality. I have never had Gazelle. I've done this several times, and I don't think I've even heard from listeners that have had this issue. But Gazelle, typically, they give you a guide as to picking the quality of the device, and they really stick with that. You know, I've never misjudged a device except once. I said it was good and they said it was excellent. So they actually wound up giving me more money, but they stopped. They said, wait a minute, before we send you your money, we need to tell you we've deemed that the quality of this device is different than you did. So we want to make sure you're okay with this. Can we send you more money for your device? Now, if you had overstated the condition of your device, it would happen on the reverse side, as it should. But they don't do anything that would change the nature of the deal. Even if it's something that presumably would be in your favor, they wait for you to say, yep, I'm good with that, which of course in this situation I did, and they then sent me my money. I choose to get my money from them via PayPal. You can have them write you a check if you prefer it that way, and you can also have them give you an Amazon gift card, and oftentimes you get an extra I think it's an extra 5% on top of that, because they're giving it to you as Amazon bucks. So if they make it super super simple. They are great people to deal with. Their customer service is fantastic, and we've heard countless stories from folks that have just had great experiences. They just go out of their way. They understand over there at Gazelle that every business is the customer service business, and it's really important. There's unfortunately some vendors, surprisingly even, that don't get that in every field. And Gazelle totally gets that, and they live by that. So check them out, gazelle.com. Through the checkout process, you will be given an option to tell them where you heard about them. Mac Geek Gab is in the drop down there, so they make it super easy. You just choose Mac Geek Gab, and that is that. So check them out, gazelle.com, and you can start turning your old electronics into cash, which, hey, cash, right? That's good. Or Amazon bucks, which for most of us is exactly as good as cash, because we spend all our money at Amazon anyway. So check them out, gazelle.com. All right, let's...
I like cash. I like cashes. They speed things up.
Cash is good. Cash is good. Yeah, well, you know.
Both cashes are good.
Right, that's right. Well, cash can speed things up too. Money talks.
You could use your cash to buy a cash to cash your cash.
You can. In fact, we used to spend money to buy cash, but now it just comes with our computers and devices. It's you know, to how
cashception.
That's right. All right. You know, this is a curious question, and I'm going to let Andrew ask it, and then we'll see what he has to say.
Hey, John. Hey, Dave. Hey, Pilot Pete. It's Andrew in Sydney, Australia. See, you got the Wi-Fi guy coming in, so I got a question for him. A couple of years ago when I was living in America, I used to go to London, England quite a bit. I had reason to buy an Airport Express while I was there, which I did. And when I got it back to configure it in the hotel, it would only bring up in the countries that you could choose, European countries. And I was wondering why this Airport Express, and it's the one about the size of a packet of cigarettes. It's not the newer hockey puck one. It didn't seem to transmit as far as the Airport Expresses that I had that I'd bought in America and I'd also bought in Australia. And it made me think, and with a little bit of Google foo, I found out that in some European countries, Wi-Fi transmitters have lower power. So I've got two questions for the Wi-Fi guru. One, is this correct that in Europe, the Wi-Fi transmission wattage is lower than, say, for the Americas, Asia, Australia versions? And secondly, is there any way with this Airport Express of being able to update the firmware to get it off the European ones and onto the Americas, Asia, Australia firmware? So that's it from me. Thanks again for everything, boys, and don't get caught. Bye.
Thanks, Andrew. Yeah, this question, as I hear it again, and this struck me the first time, it seems like there's something about African and European swallows that should be mentioned here, but I'm not sure exactly what. So
you have to know these things when you're a king, you know.
What is the channel capacity of an African swallow?
Unladen. That's right. Yes.
Well, that depends on the regulatory environment. It's flying through now, doesn't it?
It sure does.
Yeah. So there is a, so the junk bands are kind of funny things. So 2.4 gigahertz is sort of infamously the same frequency as microwave ovens. And the reason most of the junk bands have been allocated as they have to things like Wi-Fi, which is unlicensed usage, is because they're kind of junk. So 2.4 gig attenuates with water in the atmosphere and thus doesn't travel far enough for most reasonable commercial usages. 5 gig is less problematic, but most of the 5 gig channels that we have are either harmonics of that 2.4 gig water frequency, or there's something else wrong with them that makes them poor choices for propagation. And you know, as you go up and down in the spectrum and look at, you know, the next big chunk that we're getting is in 60 gig. And that's attenuated by oxygen in the atmosphere. So, and it doesn't go through really anything at all. So we're given these bands by various regulatory agencies, either FCC or ETSI, or APAC has Asia Pacific, has a bunch of different ones depending on where you are. And they're given with different power levels and rules about what channels we can use. And a lot of it has to do with incumbency. So in France, for example, and I think this has gotten better, but originally there were only one or two Wi-Fi channels that you could use because the French military had reserved the rest of them for some targeting system, right? So you can, yeah. So, I mean, it's one thing when the FCC van comes by. It's another thing when a, you know, guided missile decides that your access point is really its target.
Yeah, that's bad. That's bad, right?
Not the best outcome for you. You know, usability wise, that's not a good scenario. So,
yeah, but you're almost guaranteed not to have interference on that channel while you're using it.
Up to the point where you have infinite interference. Sure.
Well, right, exactly. Yeah, well, you won't find interference on that channel. It finds you.
There you go. Exactly. So don't get caught. Is that our phrase now?
That is.
Never,
oh yeah.
You never see. Yeah, you never see the white van until it's too late. Is sort of my favorite. So, you know, one of the jobs of the client team people that work on this stuff is figuring out and mapping out what regulatory compliance means in what regions. And typically we have there's sort of an FCC region, which is almost all of the Americas. Canada and Mexico just sort of go along mostly with what we say. There's ETSI, which covers most of Europe. It's European telecommunications something. APAC covers most of Asia and the Pacific, including probably Australia, where the caller's from. Each is different and special and unique, and some are better and some are worse. And the problem with roaming devices and clients, of course, is that now I have, you know, my phone and my laptop, you know, like I was purchased in the United States, but suddenly I find myself on European vacation. So what channels am I supposed to use? Unfortunately, I don't think there's any way to change an older airport express like the one he's talking about. We're going back to the 11G express again. And I don't know off the top of my head if that one's resettable after the fact, unfortunately. And so you might find an answer on the internet. I don't have that one in my head. The way most access points work now is you can tell it what region it's in, and it will do, the access point will do two things. The first one is it'll beacon that, it'll advertise and say, okay, hey, welcome to America. And that's how clients who see that beacon can say, okay, it looks like I'm in America, so I'm going to search for these channels. The problem, and you know, your friends, our callers, neighbors might be noticing this, is that if an access point sees multiple country code beacons, or if a client rather sees multiples, it can have a very hard time deciding who to believe.
Oh,
And some countries, and like I said, so, you know, you have the case of sort of the French military owning a chunk of 2.4 gig and not wanting to give it up. Different countries have different lists. They're even within the United States, in 5 gigahertz, there are incumbent radar operators in 5 gig. And so there are a bunch of the 5 gig channels are what we call DFS. And so what the radio, you're not allowed to transmit on them until you've listened for some interval to make sure that there aren't radar chirps in the background. So a big chunk of the 5 gig spectrum you know, before you can use that channel, you have to, you know, listen and make sure that you're not interfering with an existing radar operator. that slows down the scanning process. It takes longer to scan those channels. And if your client has a mismatched list, it's going to get, it's, it might skip a channel that it would otherwise have searched. And so you start seeing problems like missing access points and other things. What would be nice, I think, is if we got a better international agreements in place as to, you know, what channels we're going to make available, and at what power levels. I think that's sort of the longer term solution. You know, shorter term, if you have out of country gear, it's nice if you can change it to whatever the correct locale is, because that's just polite. I know people in the industry who have, you know, neighbors with a German access point that just drives them up the wall because they see it and they know. So this is, you know, regulatory, anything regulatory is going to be complicated. And yeah, it sounds like you've run into an interesting problem.
Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
all right.
If I'm to understand. So I was just dabbling with the airport utility while you were talking here, and annoyingly enough, I see differences. So I have two different airports. I have an Airport Express, which is newer, and I have a Airport Extreme, which is older. Mm-hmm. And even that, I notice when I go to both of them. So if I go to the airport utility, the wireless tab, and then wireless options, there's an option for me to list the country that I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
And so from what I'm seeing, it seems to be isolated here. So I'm looking here and it says Argentina, Brazil, Canada, blah, blah. I'm going to assume I have a North or an Americas airport, I guess. And then that they let me fine tune it to where exactly I am. Of course, I say United States, but I could say U.S. Virgin Islands, Peru, Mexico, Guatemala.
Yeah, the one I've got's the same. It's all Western Hemisphere.
Or Western Hemisphere. So is that, at some level, fine-tuning what channels or power levels it can use or not use?
Correct. Yeah, that'll put you in the correct regulatory regime. So that's I haven't had an opportunity to travel with these base stations much, so I generally can't give you a good answer on this one. This will take some. We might have to take this one offline and do some digging.
Okay.
Interesting. Yeah, well,
right, but it does bring up a good point. I had not realized, and actually you bring up a great point, is that this is included in the beacon, and that if you set it, so say I bring my base to Mexico and then I start using it, I could be causing grief for everybody around me because it's going to be saying, "Hi, I'm in the U.S. And it's like, "No, you're in Mexico. No, you're in I didn't know that was part of the protocol. So,
right. No, yeah, it's 802.11D provides country code information elements in the beacon frame. So, yeah, that goes out. And iStumbler displays them. So you can see.
Hey, there you go. There you go. All right. I'm going to bring us out. We'll have one last question here, which actually was asked by several listeners this week. It isn't specifically Wi-Fi, but I think it's a good conversation for the three of us to have. And really, the question comes down to this. We've got some users, some listeners who, for various reasons, want to know how they're using all of the bandwidth that their ISP says they're using. They have, you know, I think they're both with Comcast, and they have ways of, Comcast has told them, you're using X amount of bandwidth. One guy is actually moving to a more rural provider and, will get a whole lot less available bandwidth when he does this. And so he wants to know, how is this working? How, you know, what am I doing that's using all of this bandwidth? And it's a tough question. There is no, off the top of my head, there's no magic way of saying, yes, half of it is email and half of it is web surfing and half of it is Netflix. Because that would be a bad thing to say, but I can't even say that. I don't know what answer to give him. So, John, do you want to start this one and then pass it off to Al?
I think I'll start it and then pass it to Al. So I found various tools, and I guess I'll just open it up. I won't drill in too deep because I want to throw it to Alf and just see how he can catch the ball here. But to me, there are two places that you could do this. So one, you could do this on the router. router. And I would say for the most part, except for the most recent Apple router, which decided to gut the SNMP, Simple Network Management Protocol layer, there's no way to ask it, hey, how much traffic has passed through you? As far as I know, maybe there's a secret way, but SNMP, as far as I know, is the way to do that. The other way to do that is to install something on all of your computers or clients, not just Macs, but your iOS devices and all that, and say, hey, can you tell me how much you're using? And I guess I'll open it up with that, is that to me, that's maybe a good solution. Or a third solution would be that there's somebody outside of your environment, like a proxy server or DNS or something like that. So I'll offer not one, not two, but three potential places you could do this. So one on each of your devices, two on your router, and three, an external box, whether it be a proxy server or DNS. To me, those are the three places you could do it. I haven't really thought about it too much. I have a few things to throw in, but I'd like to get your take on it, Alf.
Well, I think your first line of defense is actually built in. So you have Activity Monitor on your macOS systems. And if you're running the most recent 10.9 builds, if you go to the network tab in there, it will actually tell you per application how many bytes you've sent and received for the duration of the app running. So if you do want to find out on your...
And that's the key, though. Is that if I quit the app, then that goes away.
Yeah, I habitually run Activity Monitor in the background just as, you know, power user tool.
Okay.
But
if I'm continually running an app, then so say I'm always running Safari, as mm-hmm. long as I don't quit it, then okay, and that's awesome. Yeah, I noticed that too. The utilities in Activity Monitor in the latest OS is just the latest released OS is just awesome in the amount of data it gives you. So yeah, I'm with you on that.
It was a huge, big improvement in this version. I'm happy they did that. It is possible in macOS to, you know, track, and obviously they're doing this here to, you know, track process by process how much bandwidth is being consumed. So that's kind of the first line of defense. I have I actually investigated a number of different SNMP utilities for doing this on the router, and generally they will give you how much bandwidth that you're using, but they don't do what we call application recognition, which is to say, okay, well, this was a web traffic for Facebook, and this was your BitTorrent traffic, and this was not that you would be using that, and you know, this was your Tor traffic, not that you'd be using that. Broken out. So that's actually a fairly high end router network management feature. Unfortunately, I think this is something, you know, this is, again, we get back to, you know, the job of usability in the networking space is to get out of the user's way as much as possible and just let them download cat pictures, because that's what they really want to do on the one hand. But then, you know, if you are having trouble, I think, and this is, you know, the part where I like to think I contribute some, having good tools that clearly point out to you what's going on, you know, so having visibility, I think, is pretty important. And so I just dug through my applications folder here. So NetUse Traffic Monitor is one that, you know, I've used to monitor total bandwidth on the router. And that seems to work reasonably well, or it did last time I used it. There are a number of other SNMP tools that I tested out. I don't think any of them I found to be particularly. this is the one I'm gonna say it's worth checking out. But again, this is, you know, what did I say earlier when the guy was talking about location specific settings? There's an opportunity here.
So. Yep. Yeah. But you know, so I mean, we have potential abilities to test these with our computers, but and track this with our computers. But how do we mm-hmm. track what our Apple TV is doing? How do we track what our Roku box is doing? Right. That then becomes something very difficult to do with the current environment of routers that we have.
And the reason being, you know, we talked about that new router having two, you know, a dual core 800 megahertz processor. So what you're, you know, the routers, your networking equipment in general is, you know, the sort of original design goal for most of the internet protocols was that routers should be able to make their routing decisions very quickly and without, you know, delaying the traffic. Right. So routers routing equipment access points, they strive to be relatively dumb in terms of what they do to the traffic that passes through them, right? Their job is not to inspect, you know, it's like the postal service, right? If the postal service opened and read every email that you, or every physical mail that you sent around, like, not only would nobody use it because of the privacy issues, but it would also run incredibly slow, right? So prior restraint is an expensive operation no matter where you're doing it. So yeah, to have the ability to sort of tap the network flow and look at it in a way that's comprehensible, you know, I don't know if you guys have probably got some experience with the sort of, you know, protocol analyzers that people use. None of them provide particularly good or particularly clear view of how much traffic is going where, and none that I've seen. Maybe the closest one, and this is focused on layer two, is the IPA, EYEPA, which is a Windows only program, unfortunately. But it provides basically a sort of pie chart of where all of your airtime is going, right? So that's useful for people doing, you know, Wi-Fi protocol debugging, but something very, very similar, you know, where is my network time doing? I think where is all my network time going is a totally valid question. And you know, whether we separate out what's happening inside the connections or not, I think just having statistics, right? How many packets have I sent into, you know, Facebook's network or, you know, some other particular target is useful information. So, yeah, I would love to see routers provide much better performance information, because I think, you know, user experience for networking in general is a CPR thing, is my rubric for it. You need connectivity, you need performance, and you need reliability. Once you have all three of those together, then the network's really working for you. Anyone of those failures is you know, ruins the rest of the game. So
yeah, right. Well, it's like you said, there's opportunity there. So
I know this is great. I've got product plans for the next 18 months,
right? I know.
Just from this one show.
That's right. Well, that's what we're here for, is asking the tough questions. So all right. Well, we have asked a lot of tough questions, we've given a lot of tough answers, but we're now at almost an hour and a half, so it's time to move on. It's been fun, though. Thanks for hanging out with us, Alf. Alf, we're going to go through and tell people how to find us, and then after that, we're going to have you one last time tell us how to find you. So you can find us if you need to send in a question or comment, as one of our listeners, I think it was Slough, mentioned. It is, in fact, feedback@macgeekgab.com. Right, John?
Dave, I wasn't sure I heard you, if you can hear me, but I do believe you said feedback@macgeekgab.com.
That's right. And you can call us at 206-666-GEEK, which, John, is
4335.
And pick one other way, John, that folks can contact us.
Well, we're on the Twitters. I am John F. Braun. He is Dave Hamilton. That other guy who sometimes hangs out very close to Dave is Pilot Pete. The podcast is Mac Geek Gab, and the publication is Mac Observer.
And that's
on Twitter.com.
That's a perfect time to throw it to you, Alf. Why don't you tell us again where we can find you and all of the stuff that you're up to?
Yeah, absolutely. So iStumbler is istumbler.net. That's I-S-T-U-M-B-L-E-R. .net. I'm on the Twitter as iStumbler and on Facebook occasionally as iStumbler. There's a page there that you're welcome to like and enjoy the occasional post on. And if you need to send an email, just alf@istumbler.net is the best way.
Sweet. Thanks for thanks so much for hanging out with us, Alf. This has been a blast, frankly. And so we will definitely look forward to hearing from you again when, I don't know, either when the Wi-Fi questions pile up or when you've got something cool to talk to us about. So I definitely want to thank Michael Johnston. He is the host of the iOS show, also the publisher of GetAppler.com. He publishes he creates the chapterized enhanced AAC version of this show for all of us here and all of you. Let's see. We also want to thank Cashfly, CACHEFLY.com. because they do a great job over there getting the bandwidth from us to you. The podcast marketplace includes Barebones Software, Smile at smilesoftware.com, Gazelle, as we mentioned, Squarespace at squarespace.com/MGG, lynda.com/MGG, iFixit, all through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. John, any lasting advice? Alf did share it once during the show, but I figured it's best to share it one last time here.
I think Alf got away with it, and that the advice is basically don't get caught.
Made up.